On this episode, Deacon Bart Gingrich interviews Father Matt Colwin on the latest in New Testament studies. Welcome to the Anglican Podcast, Faith and Honor. Thank you for joining us. On this podcast, we hope to discuss many issues of interest to Anglicans worldwide on matters of history, doctrine, and values. The following is a recording of us having one of such discussions. It is important for us to know what you think, so wherever you happen to be listening, on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, and YouTube, please drop us a line and let us know what you think.
Hello, this is Bart Gingrich, and welcome to the Anglican pastoral study that we will work on as time goes forward. I'm here with Father Matt Colwin. He is with us at reporting in from Reformed Episcopal Seminary. Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My background is in classics. I'm the child of two classicists, and I got my PhD from Cornell University, writing a dissertation on Greek philosophy. So I'm kind of coming at this whole theology enterprise as a bit of an outsider, but an outsider with a scholarly background.
Now, you aren't in the academy necessarily right now. You just came back from the Philippines with your family, actually doing mission work, which is remarkable to me. Now, can you tell me a little bit about where you're headed from there and how your background plays into that?
Well, the missionary work that we were doing in the Philippines was primarily, we were located there for my wife, who is a midwife, and she was working at a charity birth clinic. But it quickly became clear that God had plans for me to use my past studies and scholarship in order to help pastors there. So the church that we were with arranged a Greek class. So I taught biblical Greek to a bunch of Protestant pastors, and I taught some Latin for homeschoolers, and lectured on biblical studies on occasion. So there was an opportunity to do some teaching there.
Wow. Well, we're actually here today to mostly focus on the subject of New Testament studies, particularly what has been happening in the past, I'd say decade or so, but certainly focused on the work of Richard Bauckham, N.T. Wright, and others, especially as it relates to changing the face of the theological academy in the realm of New Testament studies. Now, before we start talking about the folks we are going to focus on, why don't we talk a little bit about the context where they walked into? They didn't come out of nowhere, and they're addressing a certain audience. So why don't we start with that?
But before you go on to that, let me back up and sort of tie that in with our missionary work. One of the things that we've found, that I've found on the mission field, is that other nations sort of lag behind the United States as far as the scholarly trends and the theology that they're familiar with. What are pastors drawing on from their seminary education or from their own reading that makes it into their sermons and trickles down to the man in the pews? And when I showed up in the Philippines and started sharing things that I had read from N.T. Wright and Richard Bauckham with Protestant pastors there, it was a revelation to them. They got tremendously excited, and they got excited the same way I did when I discovered these things in the early 2000s when I was finishing my doctorate. I actually probably delayed the completion of my PhD by an extra year. I was supposed to be writing on Greek philosophy and Heraclitus, but I discovered N.T. Wright, and I started reading everything I could get my hands on by him. And as you know, one of the reasons that he's going to be, if he isn't already, sort of the Boltman of the new generation. He bestrides New Testament studies world like a colossus. One of the reasons that he does that is because he's just absolutely prolific. He just tosses off a book every morning, it seems like. And so that there was a lot for me to read, and I got excited about it.
Very good. So we're going to talk about, first of all, the context in which N.T. Wright and Richard Bauckham speak. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Academy looked like when they started really taking off and when they started writing their work?
I've read some interviews with Wright in which he talks about the atmosphere when he was doing his doctoral studies, and that Bultmann was the orthodoxy. You were expected to have a skeptical approach, that actually believing in the resurrection as a historical fact, or thinking that the New Testament represents reliable historical testimony about things that happened in the first century. All this was, basically, if you held those views, you were not taken seriously. And so Wright, part of what makes it remarkable that he's attained the stature that he has is that he did his studies under leading lights of New Testament scholarship. He wrote his dissertation under Caird. He had personal friendship and knowledge of, you know, Cranfield and other UK leading lights of New Testament studies. So he sort of made it his goal to overthrow that skeptical orthodoxy. One of the things that I've noticed coming at it from, as an outsider from classics, is that there very much is an ebb and flow of scholarly trends. And just as the mission field follows behind the United States and the UK in adopting scholarly trends in New Testament studies, so I think also New Testament studies itself often follows several years behind other fields, such as classical studies. For instance, we all started with the work of Milman Perry and Albert Lord, thinking that Homer is the result of oral tradition. And picking apart Homer had been the earlier fashion, splitting him into a whole bunch of different sources. And then you see the same sort of thing going on with New Testament studies later with the documentary hypothesis, JEDP, Q, and so forth. So when I started dabbling in New Testament studies, I would see people thinking and approaching texts in ways that perhaps had already been discredited in the study of Greek and Latin literature.
So you have this issue. So you have this world in which, if I may, I don't know if this is a good summary, but if it's all textual based and there's little understanding of oral, how the oral works, how memory works, how testimony works, that is outside of the post-printing press age, if that makes any sense. We live in an age of newspapers and of text, and then that's really not the best way to understand how the ancient mind worked, how the ancient world worked, and even just how testimony works in general.
Okay, you're touching on an issue that Richard Bauckham really deals with in Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. What is our epistemological approach to an ancient text? And I think if you look at someone like Bart Ehrman, he's presupposing in his skepticism towards the New Testament text that it is late, that it is the product of uncontrolled and therefore unreliable oral tradition. He sometimes likes to compare the New Testament text to the final result of a gigantic game of telephone. And what Bauckham shows in Jesus and the Eyewitnesses is that's a highly biased scholarly assumption, and it's naive and ignorant about the way oral tradition actually worked in the ancient world, and especially about the way eyewitness testimony and historiography worked in the ancient world. And Bauckham, I think, really just has a slam dunk case with incredible arguments in that book that if we want to ask what is the form of the Gospels, what sort of literature are they? The answer is they are the written summary of eyewitness testimony. They bear on their face the signs that this is the product of eyewitnesses, and when this gospel comes to your church, you can consult these eyewitnesses and check up on what I've reported to you.
Now, so that's Bauckham's kind of main thesis, if I'm correct. What would you say N.T. Wright added into the mix in environment?
Well, these two are both geniuses, but they're geniuses in a different way. Wright is a sort of high-flying... he has an amazing ability to synthesize and to show how different texts and different ideas work within the mindset and the worldview and the theology of a credible ancient Jew. So in this case, we're talking about Paul's theology. So his 1,600-page book on Paul and the faithfulness of God, he draws on Bauckham and he uses Bauckham, really, I think, for some of the most important points of the book. Claims about early high Christology and his approach to testimony also he uses. Now, Bauckham is not as much of a virtuoso scholar as Wright. He doesn't generally write about integrating all these ideas into a coherent worldview. Where Bauckham excels is that he reaches out into related fields of study that are not theology. For instance, onomastics, archaeology, epigraphy, numismatics. Bauckham is unafraid to go consult philosophical epistemology. How do we approach testimony as a source of knowledge? And all these areas are really outside theology, and he has to go read books about historiography, about epistemology, about coins, about ancient names, and draw on them to make his arguments.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned ancient high Christology or early high Christology, and he also mentioned a lot of how the Jewish mind works at the time. We have, especially on Bauckham and Wright's side, the offensive matter for liberals is almost everywhere. It's painted all over their text. But to some more conservative Protestants, there's some ideas in there that are new to them as well. There is the idea, or I should say, perhaps not necessarily the first thing that comes to their mind when they think the Bible and theology, and I'm probably going to reword this later in editing, but the idea is, when we're talking, the thing that often surprises or is really helpful to evangelicals as they approach the text, or when I should say Anglicans approach the text. I'm going to start that. So when we talk about the main theses of Wright and Bauckham, you're talking about an ancient or early high Christology, and you're talking about Second Temple Judaism. Can you tell us more about how that has really illuminated more the gospel story and what the early church was all about?
The common factor with Wright and Bauckham is that they approach the whole question as historians. We're no longer dealing in Wright and Bauckham with Marcus Borg's Jesus of faith. There's no divorce between the Jesus of history and the Jesus of theology. Right? They are, in fact, one. Wright has this elaborate metaphor at the beginning of Paul and the Faithfulness of God, where he takes the book of Philemon and turns it into a clever allegory for what has happened in New Testament scholarship, that history has sort of run away, and maybe we can bring this runaway slave back and find that he's really useful. These are arguments that Wright and Bauckham are making for I might say, tenets that evangelicals, fundamentalists, Bible-believing Christians have long accepted, often for other reasons. So, for instance, the historicity of the resurrection. So Wright wrote a 900-page book arguing that this is the best explanation for the evidence. Right? You can't have an executed Jewish Messiah whose movement continues after his execution, because we have lots and lots of historical evidence about what usually happened when the Romans strung up or otherwise destroyed the leader of a messianic movement. And Gamaliel recites the sorry history in Acts. Judas of Galilee and Theudas and these other deceivers, after they get executed, their movement fades away and their followers are dispersed. But that's not what happened with the early church. And so if you're a liberal and you think this didn't happen, you really have some splaining to do. That's in a nutshell, that's the way Wright approaches it, is as a historical datum to be explained, and the resurrection is the best explanation for that. And the arguments that they're making, they're not simply, this is what we've always believed, or this is the faith of the church. It's, as a responsible historian, this is where the evidence points.
A lot of people aren't used to that in some areas of the academy, really, and in the wider church. But what's fascinating to me as well is there's also bringing in the idea of Yahweh and understanding how Yahweh connects to Christ's ministry and how there is an ancient high Christology. Can we talk a little bit about that, especially considering so many... Bart Ehrman comes to mind. So many folks try to say the church made Jesus into a god, right? What kind of really undercuts that idea that we see in these new studies?
Matter of faithfulness to the text and showing how it coheres. To wit, if it were really the case that the church took 250 or so years to divinize Jesus, to deify him, with the Council of Nicaea being the crowning moment. If that were really how it all worked, then, again, we would have very deep and difficult puzzles. And the silence of the Jewish critics of the early church, of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the other opponents of the apostles, they would have jumped all over the church if the worship of Jesus were seen as a compromising of Jewish monotheism. But we never hear this criticism. It's utterly absent from the ancient sources. It's utterly absent from the pages of Paul's epistles. He never had to defend his doctrine from the charge of polytheism, which is, of course, what modern Judaism and modern Islam level against Trinitarian faith. You're worshiping the Father, but you're also worshiping the Son, and you're also worshiping the Holy Spirit, so you have three gods. And what I think Barkham and Wright show is that that was never how the deity of Jesus and the identity of him and of the Spirit with Israel's God was conceived. It was never a tritheistic faith. Rather, the inclusion, as Barkham puts it, the inclusion of Jesus and of the Spirit in the identity of Israel's God is done in a deeply Jewish way, which is one of the reasons why it's just completely impossible that it should have been foisted onto the New Testament text as a product of the church's theologizing for 200-plus years. If it had been something that Gentile church fathers made up, if it had been a product of Hellenistic polytheism grafted onto the Bible, then it would not look so very, very Jewish. It wouldn't have the form of working Jesus into the Shema. Even if there are many gods and many lords, for us there is one God, the Father, and one Lord, Jesus Christ. It wouldn't take the form of its extremely Jewish imagery, Old Testament imagery, applied directly to the Son and to the Spirit. Jesus walking on the sea, as in Job 8, or the Spirit dwelling in the church as a new temple. That's obvious Shekinah imagery, that the Spirit is the tabernacle and glory presence of God in the new temple. So all these are deeply Jewish ways of thinking about it, and they do not fit with the false story of sort of retrojected Gentilizing high Christology, only being a product of the 4th century or late 3rd century church.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting to me, and what I want to know from you, are these more are these more skeptical claims coming from the older liberal academy, if you will? Are they starting to make their way into the missionary context, into the wider church world, or are they mostly relegated to the West?
I'm excited about missions right now because, as I said, there's this lag of maybe 20 years between the scholarship that happens in the UK and the Western world, North America, and then eventually it trickles into the mission field. It trickles into the developing world, into Southeast Asia, into Africa, and so forth. And I did encounter, actually, during a trip to West Java, I was hosted by an Indonesian pastor, and he and I had dinner and started talking, and he was basically still stuck in Bultmann and in liberalism. For him, what mattered was the Jesus of faith. These stories are inspirational and life-changing, and we need to get people to believe them, but we don't really care if it really happened. The resurrection as a historical fact is neither here nor there. And it's not that he says it didn't happen. It's just that he doesn't really care that much about whether it happened. Whereas, of course, that's extremely alien to the New Testament faith. And 1 Corinthians 15 says, if Christ is dead, then we're all still in our sins. And it really is a matter of things that were not done in a corner. They're historical facts. That's what distinguishes Christianity from nearly every other religion, is that it makes falsifiable claims about history. So, yeah, that is on the mission field, but I'm expecting the waves are going to sweep that away, and we're going to have a very interesting next 30 years or so of Southeast Asian, African, and elsewhere missions that are bringing the fruit of today's New Testament scholarship instead of Bultmann, Borg, and so forth.
Now, you have you not, been involved with training pastors in various parts of biblical scholarship, and you're also looking towards a future of doing the same. Can you tell us a little bit about how that has played out in your ministry?
I'm still in correspondence with my Filipino pastor friends who studied Greek and Bible with me. And it really was post-seminary education. One of my REC rector friends in New Jersey, Jerry McLean, when I described my ministry in the Philippines to him, he said he wished he had that. He wished that after seminary he had had a group of pastors that got together and read the New Testament in Greek and talked about it for a few years. And that's what we did. We just sat down, and having trained these guys in Greek all over again, right? Their seminary Greek was, as usual, useless. So we had to sort of start from scratch and rebuild it with a classical Greek book. And that took about 8 months. And when they were done, they were indeed reading the New Testament with me. And we got through about 80% of the New Testament during our time in the Philippines. And that's just invaluable. When you pastors read together, they come to a mutual understanding about what the text means. They're able to ask questions. They're able to think as a group of minds striving toward a common goal. And so that really changed the way, especially Pentecostal pastor I was working with, and a Baptist elder who were in the class. They still come back to me by Facebook message or email, and they'll ask me, I'm thinking about this for my sermon. What do you think? Or they'll express that they were teaching a class and they had questions from their audience, and because of the things that we had read and discussed together, they had a completely different view of the matter. and that their audience found that things just fit together. And I'll write back, yeah, that's the fruit of reading N.T. Wright. Things fit together and they make sense. There's illumination.
Fantastic. Well, Matt, if somebody wanted to get into this scholarship, where would the first few books you would direct them to?
Are you asking for somebody who is of a scholarly bent, a seminarian, for instance, or you're asking for a layman?
Let's start with the layman.
As you know, N.T. Wright has a sort of Clark Kent and Superman thing going on with his ordinary laity-aimed books that are written under the name Tom Wright, and then he writes his fat, footnoted tomes under the name N.T. Wright. And so I think maybe the best place to start would be a little book that he wrote called The Challenge of Jesus, which is a popularizing and an easy-to-read presentation of the main theses of what's probably still N.T. Wright's greatest work, Jesus and the Victory of God. So it puts, for a lay reader, Jesus in his historical first century Second Temple Jewish context and shows how it all fits together. I've used that with high school students, high school seniors, and they enjoyed it very much. That's where I would start.
Now let's go with the seminarian / scholarly bent person. If they really want to jump in, where's going to be a good starting place for them?
As you know, N.T. Wright's magnum opus is his planned 6-volume series called Christian Origins and the Question of God. And he wrote the first volume of that, The New Testament and the People of God, as a book that would fill in his first-year graduate students on all the necessary background that they were usually lacking. And so it's a great way to get oriented to Wright's project and to sort of modern conservative New Testament studies generally. And then after that, you know, the rest of that series, I think, is just transformative, and it's going to stand as an incredible monument in New Testament studies. Each volume is just extremely powerful. Jesus and the Victory of God is probably the most celebrated work of New Testament studies in the last 50 years. There have been many symposiums and festschrifts organized with Jesus and the Victory of God as sort of the foundation that everybody is bouncing off of, and it sparked so many new avenues in New Testament studies. The Resurrection of the Son of God is sort of more specialized. It's a defense of the resurrection and a showing that this is Paul's teaching, this is the New Testament's teaching about Jesus actually rising from the dead as a historical fact. And then Paul and the Faithfulness of God, 1,600 pages. Obviously, Pauline scholarship, not Jesus scholarship, but again, I think it's going to stand as a monument. So if you're a seminarian, those are the books you should go to. Skip the short stuff and dive into the masterpieces that he's written.
All right, thank you.